on the third point, turn all mishaps into the path, turn all disasters into the path. And we were talking about drive all blames into one. That's one slogan that appears under this point. And we were talking about be grateful to everyone for everything. That's another slogan that appears under this point. So let's go on with a few more under the same point. The next slogan says, see confusion as the four bodies. So this requires a little explanation. To make it simple, in Buddhism there's a teaching about the four bodies of Buddha, or the three, usually in Mahayana Buddhism it's the three bodies of Buddha. Dharmakaya, reality body or truth body, Sambhogakaya, the trance body or luminous body, and the Nirmanakaya, the appearance body, meaning the body of the Buddha that appears in this world. So, in a way, that's not so important. The point here is, see confusion as the Buddha, is the idea. See your own confusion as being an emanation of the Buddha. So this is kind of an astonishing thought, because we always realize that our confusion is the opposite of the Buddha. You know, we have to get rid of our confusion to find the Buddha or be the Buddha. Our confusion is standing in the way. So the thought that we should see our confusion differently and see our very confusion as the body of the Buddha or as the Buddha himself or herself, this is a kind of a really counterintuitive thought. So what can this mean? Well, I think it kind of reminds me of the way we've been practicing this weekend. We've been sitting and walking and talking, reflecting, maybe in our minds we've noticed various things coming and going. It's a process. You know, life is a process, isn't it? It's a flow of experiences, one after the other. When we get confused, part of what happens to us is that we get entangled in the confusion. We identify with the confusion, we blame ourselves or someone else for the confusion, we have a strong desire that the confusion will end, and will go away. I use the word confusion, but it stands for all afflictive mental and emotional experiences, anger, resentment, pain, whatever. So as soon as those things arise in us, we get entangled in them and we identify with them. But the truth is that from the standpoint of the process itself, there's not that much difference between confusion and pleasure, pain, wise thoughts, stupid thoughts, you know, torturous emotions, pleasant emotions. When you kind of take a step back or to the side and you look at the flow of it all, it's all part of a flow. What's really happening is the experience of the flowing of one impression after another. Isn't that true? It's kind of like when you're out there walking. You get into the flow of walking, and all kinds of things might be happening. Perceptions, thoughts, feelings, sensations in the body. But it's all subsumed under the flow of walking back and forth. And you might have a very unpleasant thought, but it doesn't sort of grab you, because the better part of your attention is on the flow of just walking back and forth. You can't walk back and forth unless you pay attention to it, so there's a certain amount of your energy goes into that. And so because of that, there's a foundation there for things to come and go and not be all that disturbing. Even something disturbing is not as disturbing if you can experience it as you're walking back and forth, and as you and if you see it as a flow. So when we can see our confusion and our afflictive emotion and our resentment and our bad feeling without the entanglement and without the identification and without the strong desire that it go away, and just experience it within the flow of our being, then confusion becomes Buddha. Whatever it is becomes Buddha. So it actually might not be a bad thing to try sometime. You could wait happily for the next time you're in a bad mess. I can hardly wait for the next time that something happens to me, you know, and I'm really in a pickle, and I'm really feeling bad. I can hardly wait, because I'm going to remember at that time to start walking back and forth like that, and see if in walking back and forth like that, I'll get the feeling in my body of the flow of experience, and all of a sudden I'll see that it's not so bad. I'll see that it's actually Buddha. And again, this is a very common thing. You know, maybe you saw your parents or grandparents, when they had a bad problem, start walking up and down. Maybe they did that. They started walking up and down. I don't know what to do. They walk up and down. So, and also in meditation practice, this is one of the things. This could be maybe the most valuable aspect of meditation practice, is to sit and be present with the flow of one's experience coming and going. And once you stop entanglement and stop identification and stop avoidance or trying to push away, then even the same confusion or afflictive emotion or anger, resentment, whatever it is not so bad. And you see it as another natural manifestation of life, which is what it is. It's natural that that would be the case with you in that time. Why? Because things have happened. You're a human being. You have feelings. You have a heart. So when somebody betrays you, when somebody hurts you, insults you, of course you're going to feel these things. But what will you do when that happens? Will you see the confusion as the body of Buddha? Or will you then instead, through a combination of identifying with it, entangling, getting entangled in it, and trying to get rid of it, start thinking and acting in ways that perpetuate it and make it more and more painful until you have so reified it and so clung to it in your effort to get rid of it, that you've set in motion a whole series of internal and maybe even external actions that make it even more painful. So again, you know, this is all under the theme of the whole world is upside down. You know, this is the opposite of the way we usually look at things. It's really quite a simple thing. It's perfectly reasonable. But it is the opposite of the way that we generally think about these things. There's another part to this slogan. Seeing confusion as the four bodies of Buddha is unsurpassable shunyata protection. That's the wording of the whole slogan. And shunyata is a word that means emptiness. And emptiness is another word to describe what we were talking about, I guess, yesterday, the nature of mind. Maybe we were talking about it today as well. The way that actually, when you look closely, you see that the nature of mind is things popping up and popping away. We don't quite, never can see how that happens. When we try to look and catch it, we never can. Somehow things come and go, and the more you try to grab them, the less you can. So they're not grabbable. They're not graspable. Consciousness flows. We don't know what consciousness is. We can't define it. We can't figure it out. Even with all the millions, if not billions of dollars poured into the brain work that now is being done, that's finding out all this interesting stuff about how the brain works and how emotions work and perception works and so on and so forth. If you ask these great and prominent and very smart scientists, so what is consciousness itself? They say, we have no idea. We really don't know. We're finding out some little things about how it works, but what it is and where it comes from and what produces it and what would not make, we have no clue. There's no way. In fact, our whole scientific methodology doesn't really admit of an experiment that would even get us there. It's all on another plane, on another level. So this is all to say that we appreciate, as spiritual practitioners, this sort of essential sacred mystery of consciousness, the ungraspability, the unknowability of it. And we bow before that. You know, when we, in Zen practice, one of the features of Zen practice, which I don't think you particularly have in Vipassana practice here in the West, is prostrations. We're bowing all the time, bowing. It's like a big thing to bow, bowing, bowing, bowing. Bowing to the sacred, mysterious nature of consciousness. Bowing in humility. We have no idea. We really don't know. And yet we are this. And if we release ourselves to this, we're healed. And yet we have no idea what this is, or what any of this is. So we bow, an act of humility and reverence. So when we see our confusion as the four bodies or as the Buddha, it means we're releasing ourselves to the nature of consciousness. And this is the nature of consciousness as ungraspable, unknowable. And this is the ultimate protection, because there's nothing to fear. There's nobody to be protected. There's nothing to be protected from. Within this flow, everything is its own completion. Everything is its own healing. Every loss opens to a new horizon. Every ending opens to a new beginning. Every pain automatically opens to healing. That's the nature of mind and our heart. And so, what a fantastic thing, the idea that we could find our way to that through our own confusion. Even the worst things in us, you know, our greed, our anger, our hatred, could lead us there. We don't need to get rid of them or turn them on ourselves. All we need to do is disidentify with them, disentangle ourselves from them, and see them for what they are. And when we can do that, the very confusion will show us something profound about our lives and will liberate us. You know, the afflictive emotions are actually self-liberating if we will go deep enough with our appreciation of them. So we stop seeing them as enemies, stop seeing them as spies, you know, inside our house. The next slogan says, four practices are the best of methods. This also, the shorthand requires explanation. But what I like about it is, and you'll see what I mean in a minute, there's a wonderful oscillation in this teaching. And I think it's true of Buddhist practice in general, a kind of beautiful oscillation between the recognition that we'll never, the only way we can really find peace is to situate ourselves at the deepest level in our lives. You can't go halfway. You know, only, the only way we'll find peace is full awakening. So we really have to understand our lives very deeply in order to release ourselves from our confusion. But the trouble with that is it gets very heady. You know, the emptiness of mind is something that we can talk about in a retreat as we sit here and we have 2 days to really do nothing but contemplate this. But then, you know, as soon as we leave here, life gets complicated and it becomes more difficult to contemplate this. So we also need very practical down-to-earth stuff, right? So there's this oscillation between very practical down-to-earth stuff and deep contemplation of the nature of our hearts. And in fact, we need both. We need this good advice for how to cope, you know, every day, and we need practices and teachings that will help us to see the nature of our human life. And if we only have one and not the other, either way, whichever one it is, it won't be enough. If we only have coping mechanisms, this will be insufficient, because eventually life's biggest problems will be stronger than our coping mechanisms. On the other hand, if we only have these deep contemplations and we have no practical tools for coping with everyday affairs will overwhelm us, because we will probably never in our lifetime go deep enough with these, because the depths are endless. So here, after the last slogan, which says, see confusion as the body of Buddha, and this is the ultimate protection of emptiness, this is a very profound reflection. And although it's not hard to understand, it's hard really to see, to actually be in the midst of your confusion and really see it that way. It really, you could imagine, that would be pretty hard to see it that way. So then this next one offers some very concrete and very simple-minded practical help. Four practices. So what are the four practices? The first one, they're unbelievably simple and concrete. The first one is accumulate merit, which means like do good things. You know, pretty simple. And good things is everything from, you know, go to church on Sunday, go to meditation retreats, practice meditation, say kind things to people, give to charity. You know, there's a billion things, concrete things, that one could intentionally make up one's mind to do. And the idea is that this is an actual thing one could do. And in doing such a thing, it has a positive conditioning on your mind. And it really is true. I mean, if you make a practice of saying to people in your life, you know, how are you? Are you okay? What's going on with your life? Things that we commonly say, but imagine intentionally saying those things as spiritual practices. It has a positive effect on your spirit. Or giving money to charity, or going to a place of worship or a temple or a retreat or whatever it is that you do has a positive effect on you. So do pick some things like that. You know, like in Asia, people will commonly go to a temple and they'll offer flowers and they'll offer alms. They'll offer a meal to the monastics. And all these things are efforts to do this practice, to accumulate merit, to build up a storehouse of virtue in the heart. And it's almost as if, you know, virtue is a strength that you could build up, just like you could go to the gym and build up strength in your body by doing repetitive acts, right, that condition the body toward more strength. Similarly, spiritually, you can do meritorious actions that accumulate merit. This is how it's been understood traditionally in the Buddhist world. And so one could do that. One could think, what are the things that I feel good about doing that make sense to me, that seem meritorious? And intentionally do those things. So you could see how that is like in the opposite universe from see confusion as the body of Buddha and as the protection of emptiness. This is a much more simple thing. And the next one is just as simple. So the first one is accumulate merit. The second one is avoid things that gobble up your merit. In other words, do things that are positive and try to avoid things that, you know, diminish your spiritual strength and your positive energy. So we all have our own list of favorites, things that we do, that we know that we do, that, you know, erode our heart and soul, ways that we speak to other people, maybe specific other people in our lives that we speak to in certain ways that we think, eh, that's not so good. Ways that we speak to ourselves. Attitudes that we express to other people, maybe cynicism or something like that. It's easy to be cynicism or discouragement that we are communicating to other people in subtle and sometimes not so subtle ways. So we could pick one or two or more things that we might do. We also might have bad habits, like, for instance, a lot of people nowadays have the bad habit of mindless distraction, because there are so many wonderful opportunities for mindless distraction. You know, you could walk in your house and many people do, you know, turn on the television and the radio and go online. This is not that unusual. People do that. You know, they turn on the television and the radio and they go online. So there's a lot of mindless distraction. And I think probably everybody here would have to admit that from time to time there's some mindless distraction. So that would be one thing. And mindless distraction kind of, you know, erodes the spirit. So you could say, well, let me see if I can reduce my mindless distraction. So let me kind of deal very concretely with my personal habits. Maybe you drink a little too much wine at night with your, and you notice that the evening devolves. So maybe a little bit less wine. Or whatever it is that is your way of distracting yourself. That's one. Another one. So, could you imagine what would happen if you, just these two practices, if you actually left the retreat and went home and said, I'm going to take the next few hours to reflect on my habits and my life. And I'm actually going to choose thoughtfully a few things that are positive that I actually will do for the next period of time as a practice. And I'm going to choose a few things that I'll forbear from doing as a practice. Think of what that would do to your life if you actually did that. It's such a simple thing. And it's within anyone's power here to do that. And that's what they're talking about. And the next one is very interesting. It's very much a practice of Indo-Tibetan culture. So I'll tell you what it is, and then we can find a way of understanding it in terms of our own culture. And the next two of the four practices are making offerings. So you make offerings to two kinds of creatures. One is demons, and the other is protective deities. So if you're a Tibetan Buddhist, you actually do this. You actually like either visualize or have statues or pictures of demonic deities, the kinds of deities that mess you up, cause you trouble, and you make offerings to them. Please, you know, evil deity, stop messing me up. Here's some fruit for you. Here's some money. Here's some sugar or grains. Please stop messing me up. And then you go to the protective deities. Please protect me. Here's this and here's this and here's this. Jewels and gold and all this you offer, maybe imaginatively or in reality. But we could understand it. There's different ways we could look at that. We could actually do that. It might be pretty good practice for us to do that. But we could also see the deity, the demon, as our own qualities, some of our own demonic qualities, so to speak. Maybe demonic is a little bit much, but you know, our own qualities that work against us, qualities in us that we don't admire, that we wish we didn't have, that we're hoping to improve and get rid of. What would it be like to make offerings to that quality in oneself? Thank you very much, greed. I'm now offering you something to propitiate you. Thank you for being in my life. You've caused me a very interesting time of it. You know, please receive this offering. And let me make friends with you through this offering. And similarly with protective deities, that these could be your own best qualities. One could reflect on one's own best qualities, which is also a wonderful exercise to take stock of one's good qualities and to make offerings to them. Thank you very much for this this integrity that seems to be part of who I am. Thank you for all those who helped foster it in me. It's wonderful that I have this quality, and I really appreciate it, and I'll make offering to you. But in a way, an even simpler way of practicing these two is to do something that people think Buddhists don't do, but it's not so, and that is pray. You could pray for help. I think that it's a weakness of our, I think we have mapped onto our spiritual practice in Buddhism American individualism. Buddhism is a way that I can solve my own inner problems. I, through my meditation practice, will become a better person. But I think this is not going to work. I don't think that works that well. We don't do it ourselves. Anything really worthwhile, any real worthwhile transformation in our lives that's really deep, that really matters, has to exactly break outside the prison of self. It can't be, let's make, you know, stainless steel bars, you know, for the prison of self. Better bars, nicer bars, with filigree and so on. No, we have to get out of that prison. And that really means that we don't do it ourselves. That means that it goes beyond what an individual can do. Now, this doesn't mean we don't make effort. Of course, there's effort. Anything worthwhile requires effort. But the effort has to be met by a sense of our being assisted by something beyond ourselves. And that means our teachers, our community, but also the forces of the universe, however we understand them. So we can pray. And throughout, if you go to Asia, you know, the Buddhists are praying like mad all the time, making offerings and prostrations and prayers. Please help me. Please help me to overcome these problems. Please help me in this situation or that situation. Everywhere in the world, you see this. Light a candle. Give alms. Say a prayer. This is not superstition. I mean, it can be viewed in a mechanistic or superstitious way. If I light a candle, I'll force the deity to give me what I want. They'll have to do it. No, it's, you know, but I'm reaching out beyond myself. I don't know what will happen. I don't know if I'll, what I'm praying for is what I'll get. And maybe when I don't really know what I should be praying for. But this is what I feel like praying for. And something will happen. And I'll be in a cooperative relationship with the reality that holds me. How else could you live? Right? How else could we live but to be in cooperation with the world around us? We do our part, but who can dictate what the world will bring to us? None of us can do that. So we reach out to forces unknown and beyond ourselves. And so it's not a bad idea to every day after meditation. Here's an, I've got full of ideas today. Every day after meditation, you could stand up from your cushion and you could just sort of stand there and say, you know, please help me live this day. Who are you asking? Well, I don't know. And in a way, it doesn't matter, because whatever you whoever you think you're asking, it's beyond that anyway. So it doesn't really matter. Prayer doesn't require a deity, actually. It just requires one's own heart, right? You can speak and say words even if there's no one there listening. You can still speak, and something happens anyway. So this is really suggesting that you think about this, think about recognizing that your path is larger than your capacity to produce something in your life, that you need help, that you need support. And the last slogan in this section is, whatever you meet, join it with meditation. Whatever happens to you, join it with meditation. When difficulties arise, come back to the breath. Come back to the body. Everything that happens to you is part of your practice. This is, something that Rodney and I have a deep agreement about. And we always, whenever we see each other, we saw each other last night, we always talk about this point. Because both of us are in the meditation business, right? But both of us are always railing against the meditation business. Like, don't people realize it has nothing to do with meditation? It's not about meditation. It's about living your life all the time. It's not about meditation. And it drives us both wild that people think, oh, so now I went to this retreat, I'm going to go to a longer retreat now. And an even longer retreat. And maybe I could like live my life so that I'm always in retreat. But no. That's not the point at all. The point is you are always on retreat, no matter what. It's really about every moment of your life. It's about living your life every moment, wherever you are, whatever is going on. You know, meditation, there's my favorite Zen saying, is the story of Zsa Zsa, who, when he's asked what is meditation, says, meditation is non-meditation. And when the monk says, how could you say that meditation is non-meditation, he replies, it's alive. So this is really the point, that we are practicing meditation for our life. When the bell rings, we go to meditation. When the bell rings again and it's over, forget about it. Just go next time when the bell rings and don't worry about it. In the meantime, just show up and live your life and bring your whole heart to every moment of your life the same way you do in your meditation. Your meditation practice is just training you for your living. It's not something that we need in and of itself. After a while, I think we like it. It's fun. You know, we enjoy meditation. It's peaceful. It's nice. And we do it with our friends. So then we do it for them and for ourselves. So it's not that we get over meditation, but it's just that we recognize it's not really about meditation and deep states of mind. It's not about deep states of mind and enlightenment experiences. It's about every experience, all experiences, and the quality of attention and the quality of being that we bring to all of our experiences. So this one is saying just that. Whatever arises in your life, meet it with meditation. See it as a meditation moment, a meditation object. In practice, there are no breaks. You know, there's no, now I'm in retreat and now I'm not. Now I'm in retreat and it's a break. And now it's not a break. What kind of a break would there be? You know, you would like drop dead and then come back to life. I always say, you know, we will all get a break soon enough. And there's no use rushing it. So really, you know, can you bring your practice to the time when you're really exhausted and tired and frazzled? Do you have to be fresh and upbeat in order to do your spiritual practice? Well, then you're limited because you're not always going to be that fresh and upbeat. So how do you practice? You know, there's another saying in Zen, you know, sun face Buddha, moon face Buddha, which means when the sun is shining and life is bright and long, be a Buddha. When life is brief and dim and it's the middle of the night, be a Buddha then. Different Buddhas, but one Buddha. So can we practice when we're tired and frazzled? This text is all about that. Can we practice when we're angry? Can we practice when we're frustrated? Can we understand our anger and frustration in such a way that we can practice with it? So whatever's happening, whatever our situation is, we're still alive. Really, when it comes down to it, I mean, this is another thing that always bugs me, you know, that the idea that religion is like for Sunday and it's private. Like, it's one day a week and my religion is not your religion, and your religion, so we don't talk about it because it's our private business. We would sooner talk about our sex lives than our religious lives because it's very private. But it's the opposite of that. I mean, in all cultures, in ancient times, there was no word for religion. You know, the word didn't exist until much later, because it was just the way of life. This is how you live. These are the ways we live. These are the ways we meet every moment of our lives. And every culture had its own language and its own set of practices and rituals for that. And one of the challenges of our time is in a pluralistic world where people have different religious traditions. How do we cope with that? You know, in ancient times, people would live together under a particular ideology of religion. So now we can't do that anymore. We don't want to do that anymore. So that is a really big challenge. But our spiritual lives themselves are not for Sunday or for retreat, and they're not really private. We are sharing our religious lives all the time with one another, because really, to me, religious life, spiritual life, is being alive in this world with our whole hearts. That's what it is. And even when we're not, we can't help but manifest our religious lives, however imperfect they may be. So I feel like, you know, my life is doing Buddhist practice, and I'm doing it all the time with everyone, not just with people in retreats. It doesn't make any difference if I'm in a retreat or at the movies, you know. I'm always practicing with human beings who are in exactly the same situation that I'm in, have the most profound problems, and are struggling to deal with them to whatever degree they're conscious of it or actively working on it. It really doesn't even matter that much, you know, in the end, because they're going to face the same things that I face, and they are facing the same things that I've. Every moment, time is passing for them and for me. To me, that is religious life. And what we're doing here this weekend is only admitting that to ourselves and trying to engage it in a more conscious way. But even if we didn't, we would be doing that anyway. We can't avoid it. You know, how do you avoid being human when you're human? Well, you don't. There is no way to avoid it. So meet all circumstances with meditation. Every moment is a moment of practice. So I think maybe what I'd like to do now is just for a few minutes. I can go on a little bit more, but if that was all that we presented this weekend, that's enough, I think. So let's just take a few minutes to go back to meditation practice. And I will actually go through as a kind of meditation some of these points, just so that you can feel them again in your heart. Now I won't have to say very much about them because I already said a lot. So when I say drive all blames into one, that's enough. You'll have some feeling for it. So this is a kind of review, a meditative review of some of the points, okay? And the idea is, I'll say a slogan, and just sit with it for a minute, and breathe with it for a minute, and just notice what comes up. Notice how you feel. Notice if you feel like you have a resonance with it. It's a good slogan for you, it's not a good slogan for you, there's something you don't understand about it. Whatever you feel, just be with that and see how it evolves. And I'll say the slogans and leave a few breaths. Turn all difficulties into the path. Turn all difficulties into the path. Drive all blames into one. be grateful to everyone. See all afflictive emotion as Buddha. And this is the ultimate emptiness protection. Four practices. First, accumulate merit, do positive action. Second, avoid actions that corrode your spirit. Even small ones. Third, make offerings to your worst qualities. Thank them for all the merry trouble they've caused you, and ask them to accompany you on the way. Fourth, bow to your best qualities and appreciate them, and pray for help. And finally, practice with everything in your life, always. Bring everything back to meditation, to breathing, to body, to practice. Thank you. So, do you have any comments or questions or something we should talk about more? Mm-hmm.
The afflictive emotions and the four bodies. So let's take anger as an afflictive emotion. It is not, that slogan is not saying, am I correct, that one acts out when anger occurs, the energy is there, but that doesn't mean you act out.
Right.
Is that correct?
It doesn't mean that. Right. It does not mean that. It means, in a way, again, I think we were saying this before, that just like blame is a distraction from the painful event that happened that we don't want to really admit happened. Similarly, acting out our anger is a distraction from the pain of the anger itself and whatever underlies the anger. So this is saying, don't act out your anger, but see deeply what this anger actually is. And if you see deeply enough, you'll see that this anger, in fact, is Buddha. You'll see that, if you could see deeply enough. And that requires a kind of presence of mind and some, you know, training and experience, but that's what's being proposed. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is that then similar to offering, making offerings to your bag?
Yeah.
Qualities that you don't like and cause trouble. Because I'm having a hard time with that. I mean, I can see, you know, looking at it and being present with it, but, you know, asking it to continue along the path with me doesn't feel right.
So, yeah, yeah. Well, it's like, you know, if you, for example, if you take the case of anger, it's possible that if you really followed your anger to its root and really understood it and really saw it, you might discover, for instance, that what the real root of it was a tremendous passion for justice. That's why you get angry. Because at the bottom of your anger, it's all clouded over with all kinds of things, but really at the root of it, you really have a passion for justice. It really bothers you when something happens that's unfair and unjust. And so then, purifying it, you take that with you. That's what it means.
So you're like saying, come in, I really want to know you.
Yes, and I want to transform your energy, in effect, into an aid for the path. My efforts to get rid of you have been so unsuccessful that I'm trying a new way here. You know? And also, there's so much energy in those things, right? So much energy in that. I mean, I suppose we could all find, and if somebody wanted to work on this, I suppose that somebody could create some fantastic medications that would eliminate all passions, you know, from us, and make us all very cooled out all the time. But I don't think we would want that. So there's a virtue in these passions when we really tame them and make them work with us and accompany us on the path. When anger accompanies us on the path, it's a different story than when anger is pushing us off the path. But then it's the energy of anger, really, or the positive, whatever positive root it has. Yeah.
Well, I really appreciated your giving some permission or encouragement to pray, because I grew up in a very non-religious household.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember when I first sort of learned about doing metta practice in Vipassana, that I had this sort of little prickly feeling that in a way I was praying and there was something wrong with that.
Yeah.
But the more I've done it, the more I realize how it really is a way to open the heart and show your vulnerability in a situation.
Yeah. Well, I think metta practice, let's be honest, it is a form of prayer.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
I think it is.
Absolutely. Well, what is a prayer? We say, may she be happy.
Yeah.
That's a prayer. That's an expression of a hope and an intention. That's what, yeah, that is a prayer. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Something that I'm so intrigued with, because it seems to have made an impact on me, is you're talking about trying to see the moment before thinking or feeling.
Yes.
And then trying to get that moment, which is kind of ridiculous.
Pretty impossible.
But what I found in trying to do that, and I obviously I haven't really practiced it. I'm just entering into that idea. But what has happened is I have a sort of like an awareness or an insight, and what that was or is, and I'm like really struck by it, is that the connection between doing that and being present.
Yes.
In other words, if I'm not analyzing or thinking or, letting the mind do all that stuff, and I'm just trying to concentrate, maybe I have a problem with concentration, and that's helped me. So it's like, suddenly I'm concentrating on trying to get that moment before the thought, and suddenly I realize how the connection with just being present.
Yes.
It's very freeing of thought and feelings.
Yes. Yes.
Just be present if I do that.
Yes. Well, that's great. That's worth the price of admission. No, that's a great thing. Yeah, because this is the thing that I think we have no idea that all the time, even when we're sleeping, the same tape is going on and on and on and on in the mind. And we have no idea, so much so that we think, well, that is reality. That is what it's like to be me. That's it. And then we even go in meditation and the same thing is going on. And we think that is it. Well, it's a tremendous thing to all of a sudden, even just for 1 second, to realize, wait a minute, that's not it. That's not everything that I am. Oh, there's a little crack, in a little light shining through that little crack there. A freedom. I don't have to be, that's not, it's, yes, this is a big habit. And goodness knows, this evening and tomorrow, you'll be again, So it's not like, but it's really a big deal to say, oh, there's a crack, there's a little light showing through. Yeah.
And I'm very motivated to practice that.
Yeah.
New habit.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And so that's a beginning. And there's something about that there's a lot of hope in that, right? That's what you're saying. Because now don't screw yourself up by thinking that the idea is that should happen again soon and more often. This would be a huge trap. Don't do that to yourself. But it does give you a kind of faith, right? That there is a possibility here of a different way of being situated in your life. It's not necessary to be situated in the life the way you have been if you find it unsatisfactory, that there is a little bit of crack of light there. There is another way to be in your life. And so there's a kind of confidence and a kind of faith that brings. And it's not a faith of some something from the outside coming into you. It's like, I saw something about my own mind that I didn't see before, and this gives me confidence and faith.
And of course, the other thing that occurs to me is that as I practice trying to get this new habit going so that I can be more present more times, I could just see all the mind taking over, not letting me.
Yeah, right. So I think that to me, the best way to go about this is to say, so I'll practice meditation and I'll just try my best. And that'll be it. I'll do it with some discipline, like I'll do whatever it is that means to you, however regularly or wherever, however you can do it, I'll do it and I'll try my best. End of story. I'm not looking for something that should happen in a certain way, but since I had that experience that gives me some faith, I'll give it a time, however much time you think you want to give it, and I'll see, and I'll just show up and I'll do it with some discipline and I'll try my best. And then I'll see what happens, you know, after some amount of time, and I'll see if it still seems like a worthwhile thing. But that's great, I'm glad. And I can tell. No, really. Because there's something in your face and in your body that's just a little softer. I mean, honestly, there's a little release in you, in your heart. Whatever kind of pain you had, maybe you still have, but there's a little release. You can tell. So it's not just your idea. I think we can all tell. I can tell anyway. So that's wonderful. I'm very happy about that. Yeah, that's great. So, the beginning. Yeah. Yeah.
During the, just that last little bit of guided meditation where you were saying the slogans.
Yeah.
So I started out with, you know, sort of a quiet mind, but each slogan that was put in there, it seemed like it showed me something that more I had to let go of. You know?
Yeah.
It wasn't something added, it was something to let go of.
Yeah, yeah.
So that makes me, I'm sort of interested in general of techniques or how do we sort of tease these things into consciousness that are kind of going on in the background that we don't realize so that we can see them and let that go.
Yeah.
This whole set of slogans is maybe a way of doing that.
Yeah.
And then maybe, how might we use this?
Yeah, that's a beautiful point, actually. And I was just thinking about that when I was walking up and down in the hallway a minute ago. Because the actuality of this way of practicing, in the end, is the opposite of what it might seem. In the sense that, and this is how I hear what you're saying, in the sense that it would appear that, I mean, if you left here and you heard all this and you're really resolved to do it and so forth and so on, you might think, well, now I've got like, 72 new things I have to be doing now. You know, all these slogans and do this, do this, do this, do this. It's really complicated. You know, I don't know if I have time for all this stuff. And in a way, it is that. It is saying, you know, do this, do this, do this, and think this, and have this thought in your mind, and practice like this, and so on and so forth. So it's true. But the point of it in the end is just like you're saying, to let go of all of it. And I think that the living that's proposed through this training is a very free and easy, simple living. It's not a living where you're constantly remembering slogans. You know, it's a living where you're just sort of, you know, responding to things in your life and lots of letting go. Seeing how often your problems come from not letting go. And whenever you see that, letting go. So it's a very easeful, natural way of life. Particularly, you know, I think Zen practice is so much more that way. It just doesn't have any apparatus. It's more like just live. But this is a very useful training. And the end point of it, though, is really letting go of all of it and just living. But we all have to admit that we do need some cultivation and some training. So this is these are really devices. They're not really something that you need to do. They're just devices to help you cut through the pre-existing devices that we're all clutching to that make us miserable. We have to undo them, right? And so all these slogans and all these techniques are things that to help us undo what we've already done. And in the end, we let go of them. We don't really need them. So yeah, they really do amount to letting go and just facing every moment of our lives with, you know, open hearts and, you know, willing to make effort and live and be open-hearted, you know, meet what comes to us fully. Another person, the sky, pain in the body. Can we meet that fully and say, this is my life in this moment. This is it, you know. This is what I'm given here to be alive with. I embrace it. That's really, that's the only, all the slogans come down to that. Right? Yeah.
That said, then we still have all these slogans that are somehow useful.
Yeah.
And how should we use them?
Well, I think that part of the reason why I went through all of those is that if in the whole weekend, and I think it actually would be a useful exercise if any of you want to do this, to either this evening or one day soon, to just sit down by yourself and think about this. And it, the thought would be, what one or two things, either look through my notes or just I remember, that came to me that really seemed, that really touched me, that really seemed important. Can I just take one or two things and find a way to work with them? And if that one or two things is simply to practice meditation, and you don't, you haven't been practicing meditation, and you know, that would be enough, just to practice meditation. But whatever other ones came to mind. So I think not to make it so complicated and give oneself the assignment of keeping track of all these different things, but just taking something that arrives and seems important and touches you and say, let's work with that one. And it could be one slogan, if there was a slogan that came to you that seemed useful, important. Just some, for some reason or another, it just, wow, that one really got me. I don't know why. I know, I myself, when I talk about these slogans, some of them I laboriously, dutifully mention, because they're part of the study, and they don't mean as much to me as other ones. Other ones, you know, really mean a lot to me, and probably you can tell when I'm talking about them. The ones that mean a lot to me, I'm more enthusiastic about, and the other ones I'm going through, you know. But, so, you know, you can do the same. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I just wondered if it would...
You mean the metta phrases?
No. With the slogans.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh.
And if it would be useful maybe too, when one's working with a slogan and into the emotion of it, maybe the tonglen would be another way, another tool to use.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think one could experiment. This is meant to be... In fact,
it's meant to be part of the slogan practice.
The Tonglen practice is that there. I didn't recite them for you, but there are several slogans that describe Tonglen practice. And instead of reciting the slogans, we just did the Tonglen practice. But that's right. There are several slogans that describe exactly. It says, you know, start with yourself. It says, you know, use the in breath and the out breath and stuff like that. So the Tonglen,
those are slogans.
Yeah, Tonglen is part of the 7 points of mind training, right? So if any of you found one thing that I do, which I find really really helpful for me, is whenever I have a friend, and I got lots of friends, whenever I have a friend who's ill, I practice Tonglen with that person. I breathe in their suffering and I breathe out relief. And this is so good for me, because one of the things, and maybe you have this experience too, and I've had it for years until I started doing this, it's terrible when you have your friend who's sick, because there's nothing you can do. You know, no matter how much you go visit them, first of all, you don't know if you should visit them, especially if they're really sick, because then you think, well, I'm going to be a bother to them and so on. They don't really want me around, or even just calling them can be a pain. And they've got this whatever it is, and I can't make it go away. So there's a kind of feeling of impotence. Do you feel that sometimes? You know, you really feel bad. There's a kind of feeling of, you feel impotent and you feel somehow guilty or bad because you can't do anything about it. And you don't know what to do with it, because, well, if you think about it all the time, that seems unwholesome. If you forget about them, that seems bad. So what do you do about it? Well, this is a great thing to do. I feel like when I do Tonglen practice, I feel like I'm really engaged with my friend who's ill. Even if they're very far away and I can't even talk to them, I feel like I'm in touch with them and I'm engaged with them. And even though it's kind of painful to keep it in mind every day, it's also good. There's something really good about it. You know, to be in touch with the suffering of people that you love is hard. But what's the alternative? You know, what's the alternative? Like to forget about it? It's not really right either. In other words, we live in a world in which these things are going to continue to happen. They're not going to stop forever. So what are we going to do about it? Well, we have to have a way of taking in the suffering and finding relief. And it's a really great practice for that. So you could practice it just for... You could abbreviate the practice. I mean, I went through a very traditional thing, but you could abbreviate the practice, and I usually do. When I do it in an abbreviated way. And mostly, my purpose is to practice with friends of mine who have serious illness. And then that gives me... Then I feel like, you know, that creepy feeling when you call them up, and you kind of realize, well, I haven't really been thinking about them, really. And now I'm calling them because I feel like I should, and I'm a little in a funny position. I don't feel that way anymore. I feel like when I call them up, I'm right there, because they're really in my heart. And I could, and I feel like I'm in there with them, you know. It's a wonderful thing, really. And we all have people like that in our lives, so it's a really great practice for that. Mm-hmm. If you did that one thing, that would be like a revolutionary thing in one's life, yeah. Yeah.
I was really tickled when I heard you use the word slogan.
Yeah.
Because, and I have to admit that I think of a slogan as like brush your teeth with Pepsodent.
Yeah. Well, that's it. That's it. Yeah. And these are slogans, just like that.
So, and it was interesting that Deborah said, "Well, I use a different style. I call those phrases."
Yeah,
slogans.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to, you know, like I love that you use slogan, but I think that you aren't using them in a sarcastic.
No, not sarcastic.
And when
no. But they are slogans.
But
right?
It's
like that.
Love that word.
Yeah, it is just like brush your teeth with Pepsodent. It's exactly like that. I mean, it's a little bit astonishing to think that we have slogans for our teeth, but not for our soul, right? Because our soul, that's not important. Our teeth, that's another story, you know. Yeah, but no, they are slogans in just that same way. Yeah. And similarly, you could say this is a text about spiritual hygiene. You know? By the way, I forgot to say that I think that I have to end a little bit early, like maybe 10 minutes early, like 10 minutes from now or so, because I have to catch a ferry and go somewhere else, but yeah.
No, it's very accessible, you know, because then we're so, like, we know all these one-liners from advertisements.
Yeah, exactly.
Just from, you know, 40 years ago. I mean, I remember from when I was a kid, it's like, purge. I need room for important stuff.
Yeah.
But one of the things that that I thought of yesterday and then again today was that when you mentioned that in the suffering itself, inside the suffering itself, there's this... Mm. You know, very precious healing.
Yeah.
You know, like a sacred thing. See,
yeah, yeah.
Well, and during the afternoon session today, when you were talking about the different things, that like appreciating those qualities that you may consider negative, but they actually got you through
difficult times.
Or that you were very trusting in a time when, you know, maybe someone took advantage of your trust, but, you know, that you took that risk and that you want to have that element be acknowledged. You know, I just think of it as those things are sacred in and of themselves. And I thought of a quote that I heard listening to Pema Chodron. I don't know the original source, and I should because I'm a librarian. It's that there's this resistance. There's always this resistance that we have, this wall we have to deal with what you know makes us afraid or angry or nervous. You know, and so it's beyond the wall is fear, and inside, in the middle of the fear is anger, and in the middle of the anger is sadness, and in the middle of the sadness is the bright blue sky.
Mm. That's wonderful, yeah. That is the similar thing that we were saying, yeah. And I think it's always like that, yeah. Yeah.
I just want to share that I don't remember what day, but I just had the thought today when you were talking about you know, I can't wait till the next difficult thing.
Yeah.
And the immediate thought that came up with, whoa, I see it, I get it, and now I'm afraid of dying.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, and for someone, I'm in a 1 year live group and
uh-huh.
death and dying.
Uh-huh.
And one of the things I've been having a lot of trouble with is getting in touch with my own fear of dying.
Uh-huh.
And I've been suicidal in my life. In the
past, oh, dear.
And so dying has not looked like such a bad thing.
Uh-huh.
And I just had this sense of going, whoa, wait, I don't want to die, you know.
Uh-huh.
I want to have these bad things happen.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful, though. I mean, I think that, you know, the thought that life is great, even when bad things happen, life is great. I really don't want to die. That seems like a very healthy thought to have, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's right. It's great to be alive, even though we understand that bad things happen. But even bad things could be great if we took them as challenges to learn about our lives. And so, yes, I really want to be alive long enough to deepen my understanding of life. This is a great thing. So... But then again, I think there are people who say, and I believe them, they say, I'm not afraid of dying. I don't even care that much. You know, there are people who say that. And I think they mean it. And they'll say, but I am afraid of pain and like being in a bad situation or lingering a long time at the end of my life. And that frightens me. But death itself doesn't frighten me. So people seem to be different in that regard in some way. And I guess you could say, well, maybe they don't know what they're talking about. Maybe they would be afraid. But I don't know.
There's something you said about Alzheimer's yesterday. That's the one thing I could identify as being afraid of.
Yeah.
And you're talking about the past, and you have some limited amount of future.
Yeah, yeah.
And then so much past and the past.
Yeah, yeah.
We just don't... it freaks us out. But, you know, they may be...
Yeah, yeah, right, right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, and the anticipated event is never the same as the event, even in a simple-minded way. You know, the rock concert that you think of on Friday is not the same rock concert that you go to on Saturday. It's just a different thing altogether, you know. I mean, it's related, but it's not at all the same thing, yeah. Yeah.
Background being, even in my childhood as a Baptist, I wasn't much of a praying girl. And then in all my years of Zen practice, you know, I've been a sitting girl. I'm really much, you know, not into deity for decades. And I can see a way of having prayer without it being too something. Uh-huh. And I was, a few years ago, I was in kind of a bit of a rough patch, and I read this wonderful book, which I certainly recommend, called The Wisdom of the Dark Emotions.
I've heard of that book,
Mary Greenspan. Uh-huh. And in the back of the book, she gives the simplest prayer I've ever heard. It's three elements, thank you, help me, and I surrender.
Mm.
So I decided I would take up the practice of these three prayers. Mm. And it was really powerful. And I made them very spacious. I made them not to anybody,
mm-hmm.
or anybody, but I made them, and it felt like an alignment with the Dharma.
Mm.
An alignment. And so it was, thank you. And I made words to go with it initially, but then I didn't need them. It was like, thank you for my life in this mysterious, wonderful
mm-hmm.
universe.
Mm-hmm.
For everything. And it was, help me. Everything, all beings. Because there's all this help out there, all this wonderful support that we usually, when we're in that dark place, are completely blind to. So it was like this, okay, I open to this help. And then surrendering. I let go of all the sticky
mm-hmm.
places that I left home. And each one, and the more I did it, each one was less dependent on words than the actual feeling.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
I had a feeling. And it was like an alignment.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
And it was just revelatory.
Yeah. Yes, yes. How to pray, yeah. It's nobody ever talks about how would you, what would, we talk a lot about meditation. Here's how you do meditation, but how do you do prayer? Well, there's a way. Yeah. Well, thank you for
and
that.
Ever since it's been.
Yeah.
When Zazen just isn't quite helping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and we've often discussed how I'm sure that Dogen's take on Zazen is a Zazen of faith. Yeah, it is that. It's as if sitting in meditation, in our school of Zen, it's a long story, but it's as if sitting in meditation is the silent prayer.